Welcome to Culture Voice, an international perspective on the marketing of arts and culture, in partnership with the National Arts Marketing Project of the U.S. and the Arts Marketing Association of the U.K. And now, your hosts, Carol Jones and Ron Evans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culture Voice, the very first podcast. This podcast is an international perspective on the marketing of the arts and the marketing of culture. My name is Ron Evans, and I'm an arts consultant in the U.S., and I'm joined on the call here with my co-host, Carol Jones, who is a consultant in the U.K. Carol, how are you doing?
Hello, Ron. It's great to be here on this first podcast. I'm here in Cardiff. It's wet and windy, as always. I work for an organisation called the Audience Agency. We're a national audience development agency. We work across England and Wales, and we help the sector make meaningful connections with their audiences. What's life across the pond like at the moment, Ron?
It is a cold and windy California day. Sounds strange, but we live in a microclimate here that is foggy all of the time. So maybe kind of light Cardiff today. I don't know. I'll have to check the weather. I'm glad to have you here. You have a perspective that we really want to hear of things going on over there in the UK. On the US side, my company is called Group of Minds. We are an arts consulting firm that works with arts and cultural organizations in the areas of marketing and technology and consumer psychology. And so we had this idea to have a podcast that was on two coasts or in two countries and maybe expanding to the world. There are significant differences between how organizations market the arts in the US and in the UK. And given Carol's background and my background, we thought, let's talk about these things. We hope it's going to be fun because we're going to go into some areas of even vocabulary and discussion, things that don't mean the same thing here as they do there. And ultimately, we want everyone to learn from each other. This is an opportunity to find out what's working across the pond, whatever side of the pond you're on, and to open up some of those communication lines so that we can learn from each other and really make a big community of practice as we are marketing the arts. And as we know, it continues to be a challenge, but also fun. That's the other side of this too. We know a lot of you are working for organizations that you're wearing a lot of hats, and it's difficult to get everything done at the end of the day, and you're probably tired and maybe a little bit worn out. And that's the subject of today's first episode. Carol, we're going to talk about silos and how folks can feel a little bit like they're stuck. I mean, do you get that sense over there with some of the people that you're talking to, that they have a mountain that they're trying to move in front of them and it's just impossible from a marketing perspective?
I think it's a big issue here, and it's one that isn't going away anywhere fast. I also lecture at the Conservatoire here in Cardiff, and one of the questions we ask people when they come to interview to get onto the MA is, what do you think the biggest challenges are in arts management at the moment? And we usually get the reply, funding. Mm-hmm. But one of the issues I think that is really challenging is this issue of silos, and it's particularly prevalent in big organizations, I think, Ron. I'm not sure if it's the same over there, where there's different teams. You've got your team of technologists, you've got your digital, you've got your social, you've got your marketing, and each of those teams speak different languages. They are very different in their approach, and also they try and protect their area of work. And I think there's lots of challenges there.
You are preaching to the choir. I was in a situation where I was working with an organization, helping them to choose a new ticketing and CRM system. And I walked into the room, and they had gathered all the senior staff members together for this meeting with me, and I could feel the animosity between the marketing director and the development director. Development director for us is fundraising person here. And they were sitting literally on opposite sides of the table. They both wanted completely different systems and were completely unwilling to budge, saying, you know, obviously the marketing person wants to focus on selling tickets and the development person wants robust recording capabilities for donations and reminders and all those things. Good news is there are systems that do both, so it worked out well in the end. But I realized that as I walked into the situation, they're not talking to each other, and that vocabulary that we're trying to define here, and really the guarding you're saying, I see that a lot, and it doesn't have to happen that way because we should all be working in this together. Are there some situations on your side that are popping into your mind as we think about this?
I think one of the big areas is who owns social. So when social started developing quite a few years back now, marketing teams took it up and were in control of social. But now it's a very important part of the mix. I see more and more digital teams trying to take ownership. So there's this big bun fight going on in the UK about who owns social.
Wait, bun fight?
Bun fight, yeah, big heated argument.
Like I'm throwing like sticky buns at you or something?
Yeah, bun fight.
Okay, bun fight. There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, our first vocabulary exchange of the day. I was not prepared for that, but I like that visual of a bun fight. So digital is taking over, thinking that it's theirs, and people are having problems with it.
Yeah, and so I've seen now in quite a few organizations who's responsible for social moving from the marketing team to a digital team. And instead of thinking, do we need to now look at merging roles and responsibilities? Should we be avoiding working down a team with all the blocking and barriers that they create and instead think of more, I suppose you'd call it matrix working across teams? How can we work together with one key thing in mind, and that's the needs of our audience?
It's interesting that multiple people are taking over that role. Strangely, I'll go on a soapbox here for a second. Development, our fundraising side, is used to doing a specific kind of ladder of giving, right? So if you give £1 to £250, then we have a name for that, and that's like the lowest level. And then the next level up, you get certain benefits, and you're now a silver level. And then the next level up, you're gold level. But at each one of these giving points, you get something back as a benefit. At the very least, it's a thank you, which is great. Sometimes it's tickets or, you know, open a bottle of wine with the artist or all those other fun things you get when you donate. But from a social perspective, this is interesting that you brought this up. One of the things that I work with clients around is being human on social, and that is replying to people and saying, you know, comments back to them. Anytime someone likes or comments or shares, I want arts organizations to look at that as a donation. It's not a donation of money. It's a donation of opinion or of time or of just someone giving you their attention, which is so rare these days. And from a fundraising person's perspective, when a donation happens, a thank you happens. There's a call, there's a response. There's something that goes into the system, there's always an output, and that's a thank you. And as marketers, if we could think about that from that perspective, that whenever something comes in on social, that the response that is required and expected is a thank you or a comment or something trying to further the conversation. And when we do that, we see a real uptick in engagement on social. So you're talking about digital taking over. Used to be in marketing, and here I am coming in and saying that the fundraisers have the battle plan to do this. So it gets really confusing, and all these people are not talking to each other.
But the important thing there, I think, Ron, is the importance of making sure that you're working in a one-to-one way, that people understand that you know and care about their needs, what they want, and that, as you say, a simple thank you can go a long way.
You talked a little bit about different roles not speaking to each other, and we found a little bit of that recently in one of the Digital Marketing Academy projects. Before we jump into that, though, I want to talk a little bit about Digital Marketing Academy. Can you give us a background on the program and where we are with it and what's trying to be accomplished? It's super cool, and we don't have anything like that, to my knowledge, over here in the U.S., but give us a breakdown of it.
So the Digital Marketing Academy is a platform where you get to experiment, and you get to experiment with your audiences, but you also have the advantage and support from an international mentor. You're one of those, Ron, I think.
I am indeed.
And it's also supported through action learning sets. So there's three stages to it. There's your experiment, there's mentoring, and there's action learning. And by putting those three together, you get quite a unique way to drive new approaches.
Now, tell me a little bit about action learning sets too, because I don't think that's a term that people will have heard over here.
Well, action learning was invented by a guy called Reg Revens, who is a scientist. And it's really a process that involves small groups getting together, working on those real problems, taking action, and learning as individuals. So it's a way that you can solve quite complex problems with your peers. It's a very creative process. It's not directed in any way, so it's about self-learning. And the power comes from being able, I suppose, with the support of that group, to work out your own solutions, come up with some actionable, feasible ways forward. The aim at the end of any session is to leave the group feeling you can take action, you can move forward.
Mm-hmm. And you, the peer structure there really fits in with the concept of being against siloing here. The fact that other people are having the same problems that you're having or running into some of the same complex issues, it makes you feel like you're not the only one out there. I think that's really important.
And you can quite often find action learning, which happens, you know, across the world in organizations big and small, with groups that are composed of different people from different teams with different specialities. So you could have an action learning set that included a technologist, a marketer, a fundraiser. And again, that helps break down those silos.
That's interesting, because I was reading an article yesterday where somebody referenced that they like to swing a digital hammer on problems, and that we all apply our own internal criteria for the ways to solve a problem. So in a situation like that, the team that you have around you, or the peer group that you pull together, those perspectives, diversity in those perspectives is really important, because that's going to introduce different ways of solving the problem that maybe you're not thinking of, because for everything that you look at, it's about marketing, or from things that I look at, it's about psychology or what have you. And introducing other people into the mix can really introduce different ways of solving the problems. It's fantastic.
And that's what makes it so creative, Ron, I think, as a mechanism to both learn, but to make sure that you're driving action forward. So at the end of each set, you come up with action points, and you present those action points at the beginning of the next session and say what you've done and what happened. I think it also really encourages a more agile approach, which the DMA is very keen to promote. I don't know if in cultural organizations in the States you use or have adapted agile a lot. I know that Shelley Bernstein and Sarah Devine at Brooklyn Museum are real proponents of agile, and they've done lots of stuff around 6-week sprints from start to evaluation and thinking scrappy, and taken bits from that very alien, I suppose, to many of us, tech culture where agile comes from, but taken bits that actually work in a cultural setting.
There's a lot of interest in Agile over here. It can be a way to approach a problem by taking it in little steps, little bites. a definition of agile for people that aren't familiar with that word, or maybe you've heard of it. Oftentimes, the old way, still some benefits to doing it this way, is that you would map out a project from start to finish with all the milestones along the way. And if you were building, for example, a software program or an app, you would design all the features that the app would have before you sat down and actually wrote any code, because at that point you can map it all out, you can know how many resources it's going to take, and the time and everything else. Agile takes that concept and flips it on its head and rewards you for only doing a little bit and then reevaluating. Is this still the place that we want to be? Is this still the direction that we want to go? What have we learned from this small amount of time? And then we're going to write the plan for the next little segment. So you might take a large project and break it into 10 segments. And that project could significantly change from where it was at the beginning and where you expect it to be at the end, because you've been able to be agile, and adjust to the market conditions or the situational conditions in the moment. Would that fit in with your definition over there?
Absolutely, Ron. And I think, you know, I'm sure you've heard the mantra of fail fast, fail forward. Mm-hmm. But I like to think of it as succeeding speedily. I think key is pace. So it's getting that pace right. So experiment quickly, learn and move on. And it is about that test and learn approach. And getting away from waiting for that ta-da moment perfection before you actually release something. And as marketers, I think we all wait for perfection. We're all guilty of that. We don't want to do anything unless it's perfect. Yeah. And there's a lot of pressure on us to be perfect. And this approach really helps take away from that and to get away from waiting for that ta-da moment. Again, it's all about inviting the audience, the user, into the process.
Well, it's all about being okay with failure. That's a huge issue, right? So I see a million different PDFs and documents and reports and research things and all kinds of things flying across my virtual desk. What I don't often see is something that says, boy, we tried this and it bombed. Like so completely crazily, it was a complete failure. But we're putting this out there so that you can learn from our mistakes. And here's what we've done to change things going forward. What's wrong with that? That's cool. That is the spirit of the tech world. We, you know, may not always broadcast all situations because, you know, some things are proprietary, of course. But we should be open about what works and what doesn't work. And it's more about, and this is one of the things I really like about the Digital Marketing Academy and what attracted me to be a part of it as a mentor. It embraces failure in a way that I've not seen any other program do. Yes, it would be great if at the end of the 5 months or 6 months of the program, as an arts organization, you've come up with this massively cool way of learning something new and you want to tell the sector about it and it's going to fix everybody's problems on how to do this one thing. It doesn't happen very often. It has happened, and that's super cool, but that's actually not the goal. The goal is to learn how to market via experimentation and how to design experiments and test them. And the nice thing about that is if you fail, you've still won because you've learned now the process that we hope you'll carry out going forward on all of your marketing experiments and all the things that you do with marketing. And I've seen people think, oh, yeah, I didn't have that I didn't come up with that winning thing. I went in here with such high expectations. And we talk about the process being the goal here, and then they get it. And I've seen people just be so happy coming out of the program and moving forward with their operations because they have a new skill set. They've increased their capacity. Have you had that feedback from folks as well?
Absolutely. And I think one of the big impacts has been the start of a real culture shift. So not concentrating on individual wins, but actually changing the culture within the organization. And I think that's beginning to move now out into the sector. So more experimental approach, more agile approach, and less of that needs to be perfect. Yeah.
So when we're talking about sharing like this, and we're sharing our successes and our failures, that is also something that will help get you out of your silo. You don't have to be in there working by yourself. There are hundreds of other people that are facing some of the same problems that you're facing right now. And I see folks getting burnt out. You know, they've been in the arts, they've been doing too much for too little, for too long. And I hate it when somebody leaves the arts. I understand why that's the case, but I'm always looking for opportunities to make people feel a little bit better about the good work that they're doing and connecting with others and not feeling like you're doing it all yourself, siloed in your organization is really important. So Carol and I have talked about some different resources that might be useful to you coming up. One of them is conferences. Going to conference, Carol, is awesome. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to go to a conference and connect with peers.
I think that's how we met, Ron.
It is. So
that's got to be a plus. I think we met at the AMA conference here in Brighton a good few years ago. Mm-hmm. But it's such an opportunity, I think. There's the formal sessions, which, yes, can be inspirational, but it's all that networking around it. It's that discussion with peers. And that can be over a drink or a coffee or whatever it is, really informally. And that's sometimes when you get the real light bulb moments, or you just get that shoulder to cry on and share the challenges that you're facing. And that can be, you know, a really important part of a conference, I think.
Plus, it's super cool just to geek out with people that are into the stuff that you are into for 2, 3, 4 days, however long the conference is. And I just see people light up and come home from that with a new spirit and a higher morale. The Arts Marketing Association Conference is the main conference in the UK. Our main conference is called the National Arts Marketing Project Conference. And this year it's in Austin, Texas in November, which is actually going to be a great time to be in Texas because it's not hot. And if you're listening to this from the U.S. side, artsmarketing.org, go check out the website and learn more about the conference. It's super cool if you can go, especially if you're regional and you can drive there, just the ability to connect with others in that area. But it doesn't have to be a conference. There's a lot of other ways of connecting with others. I love to have people talk to their user groups for their ticketing and CRM systems. Now, most people don't think of that. But there's so much data mining and data manipulation that is a part of today's marketing position that jumping into your ticketing system to get that information is a natural. And there are tons of other people around you that use your system around the country or around the world. Check with your ticketing and CRM vendor. See if they've got some way for you to communicate with other people. Do they have a forum? Do they have a online chat room? Do they have webinars or conferences or something like that where you can connect with others? Usually conferences like that are free or are low cost depending on the system, and you can go and connect with people, and not only are you there to learn more about the system and how to use it more efficiently, but you get an opportunity to connect with some of your peers. Have you been to any conferences over there like that, Carol?
Yeah, most of the ticketing suppliers here run their own conferences, have their own user groups, and that, as you say, is a really useful forum. But do you have any buddy systems over there in the States, Ron? That's something that works quite well here, whether it's through more traditional mentoring or coaching, and people kind of buddying up to share and give experience and get some answers, work through some answers together.
There's a couple of programs, but it's not widespread. It's not a really adopted model here. Tell me a little bit about how something formal like that works over in the UK.
There's quite a lot of different schemes and initiatives. The AMA has a mentoring scheme, so you can sign up to become a mentor or a mentee, and then they match you up. So it's a little bit like blind dating in a way. Mm-hmm. You give your information to the AMA, and they then match the best mentor to the best mentee, and that works really well. I was mentoring somebody this morning, actually, and that's, I find, very rewarding, and I get as much out of it as I as hopefully the mentee does.
It's funny that I love the word scheme too, talking about vocabulary between the two cultures. In the US, scheme has kind of an evil tone to it, like someone scheming or trying to pull one over on you. And scheme in the UK, in British English, is just a plan. How would you define it other than the word scheme?
Yeah, you're exactly right. A plan.
Easy. Yeah. So when I hear loyalty scheme, I think of someone like rubbing their hands together and looking mischievously at the camera or something. And it's like, no, it's not like that at all. It's just a natural word. We don't have any formal, real mentoring program over here. I've tried to check around and see if one could get started. I think it's so good. A lot of organizations will work with each other on a regional level. We have, you know, obviously we have arts councils on a larger level, but most regions have some sort of an arts service organization. So the San Francisco Bay Area region has a couple. Austin has one. Nashville has a service organization that covers the whole region. And usually you can connect to other people through that central arts service organization because they have training sessions, mini conferences, brown bag lunches to talk about marketing, other more formal people coming in and speaking or training for, you know, doing something over a couple days' time. So reach out, look around wherever you live, see if there's an arts service organization or an arts council or something along those lines, and see what programs they have for bringing people together. It could be a great way for you to get out from behind the desk and stop being siloed and meet up with other peers. You have the same sort of situation over there, yeah?
Yeah, and you can take the initiative yourself, I think. You don't need for it to be organized. So you could do it on, you know, a number of platforms, Skype or Google Hangouts, get together with similar people who've got similar challenges from anywhere, you know, whether it could be international, and that can be low cost or no cost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, the most important thing, we've given you a few different ways of looking at the issue. The most important thing is if you're feeling like you are alone, it doesn't have to be that way. There are many ways to connect with other people. Just find one of these suggestions. Reach out to us. If you have a specific situation, contact either of us, and we'll see if we can point you in the right direction. We just want folks to feel like they are able to connect with others and to keep going. Don't give up. It's important work that you're doing, and you're connecting people to arts and cultural experiences, and that's really one of the best things you can do in life, we think. I love what I do in that role. Carol, we've kind of taken this topic, spun it around, looked at it from different perspectives. I want to move us on, if you're cool with it. There's this is the first time we've done this podcast, so folks don't know all the plan of how it works. But we wanted to come up with a little section where we would talk about a specific tool or a resource, a tip, an article, something that is something that we've individually come across and want to share with you, something that's front of mind to us. What's front of mind to you, Carol?
Well, I'm going to be greedy in the first podcast. I've got two. Oh. One is a book by Steve Krug, called Don't Make Me Think. It's a common sense approach to web usability.
Great book.
It is a great book. I mean, it was first released in 2000, and don't put up your hands in horror, everyone, saying, you know, why is this mad Welsh woman recommending a book that was written in the year 2000, 16 years ago, which is about web and usability.
Yeah, is it caveman drawings? Is that the kind of thing we had on the web in 2000?
Yeah, could be. But there was a revised edition, which is the one I'm recommending, that was released in 2014, I think. But at its heart are things that don't really change. It's the importance of sites being really intuitive. And again, what we've been talking about, involving the user at every stage of development. Mm. It really does live up to its cover name, Don't Make Me Think. It's really practical. There's lots of common sense. It's fun to read and it's short. So that's my number one tip. Okay. My number two is just to shout out about a new Twitter platform, which is in beta, which is open in the US, but you can sneak into it in the UK as well. And it's dashboard.twitter. And it's a Twitter dashboard, but it gives you alerts, it gives you analytics. There's lots of things that it's brought together in one dashboard. It is in beta, so go in, have a play with it. It's really easy to join the beta. Just ask for your organization and how many employees you've got. That's it. And then you're ready to play.
Yeah, Twitter has not traditionally had great analytics to be able to see what's going on with the tweets. So this is a welcome addition that someone is playing with this and bringing those up. Those are great resources. Fantastic. Let me jump on to mine. Mine is easy. It's only for the Mac folks, though. Don't feel bad, Windows folks. We'll have something for you soon if you're a Windows person. But on the Mac, QuickTime. It's built into all Macs. QuickTime Player does some fantastic things, and when I show it off to folks, I get a lot of surprises because they don't know that it's possible. QuickTime can do audio recordings, it can do video recordings, and it can do screen recordings. You can do screen recording where you drag the cursor wide and you can record a video of what's going on your screen, which I found to be a fantastic way to make quick training videos for folks that you want to show them how to do exactly this one thing. I just helped a client to make a training video for how to redeem their season subscriptions. And they're putting that video out to their constituency. And it just says, you know, walks them through. They printed this PDF guide that's many pages long. And some people don't learn very well from a written document. They want to be able to see it. And QuickTime can do that. It's built into every Mac. Just walk people through the process of putting in their code and choosing their dates and everything else with some beautiful branding at the front end and the end and a cheery voice. And you've got yourself a no-cost way of helping your constituencies not bump their heads on those things, not make them think, as Carol is talking about. Make it easy for them to participate with you. So QuickTime, it's built into every Mac. It's easy for you to figure out, and I encourage everybody to go play with it. Do you use QuickTime much, Carol?
I do. I like iMovie as well, which is another built-in function to the Mac, and it's got lots of easy templates. Makes it really easy to put a video together that looks really professional, even for, you know, non-techie people like me.
Fantastic. Carol, congratulations. We have gotten our first podcast down. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening in. We're going to be back. We're going to be taking other topics around the marketing of arts and culture from an international perspective. We're so glad that you're here. Carol, looking forward to talking to you on our next topic, which we'll be talking about shortly.
Well, bye, Ron. I've really enjoyed it, and I think I'll be seeing you in Edinburgh.
All right. Yes, I'm looking forward to it. Talk soon, everybody.
Bye.
You've been listening to Culture Voice. If you like this episode, subscribe and stay connected to the latest conversations on the marketing of arts and culture.